It feels like some ideas just cut through time, you know, like they're always relevant. And the principles we find in the Bible, they definitely have that feel, that timeless quality.
Oh, absolutely. For sure.
But to really grasp what those ancient words meant back then for the people who lived them,
right,
and to understand how they can truly speak to us today,
yeah,
well, we need to kind of step back in time. We need to immerse ourselves in their world. You know what I mean?
I totally agree. We can't just, like, pluck verses out of their context and expect them to have the same impact.
Right. Exactly.
Understanding that ancient cultural backdrop is crucial. It's key to unlocking their true meaning for us today.
And that's exactly what this deep dive is all about.
I like it.
We're going on a journey, an exploration of the social landscape of ancient Israel.
Awesome.
We're going to be using some amazing material from a lecture by Dr. Michael Harbin.
Okay.
It's called Social Justice for Social Outliers.
Interesting title.
And today, we're laying the groundwork, you know?
Yeah, the foundation.
Building the foundation, focusing on ancient Israel's cultural background.
Gotcha.
So think of this as setting the stage before we dive into the deeper waters of specific social justice issues.
Makes sense.
Now, Dr. Harbin, he brings such a fascinating perspective to this.
Oh, how so?
As professor emeritus of biblical studies, he's obviously deeply steeped in the ancient texts.
Of course.
But what's really interesting is that he had a whole career in the Navy before this.
Wow, okay.
So he's got this unique lens, this different way of looking at the ancient world, you know?
Yeah, I can see how that would be helpful.
Absolutely. Now, if the thought of diving into ancient cultures feels a little daunting.
A little overwhelming.
Yeah, a bit overwhelming.
Smart.
Don't worry.
Yeah.
Our goal here isn't to drown you in historical details.
Right.
We're here to distill the most crucial and surprising insights.
Okay.
To give you a shortcut to understand.
I like that. A shortcut.
Yeah. So one of the things that immediately jumps out is the stark contrast between ancient Israel and our modern world.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Imagine a society that was almost entirely rural, agrarian, relying on pretty simple tools, deeply rooted in their local community,
right,
and operating at a much, much slower pace.
Yeah, that's definitely different from our world.
It's a world apart, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're urban, post-industrial, high-tech.
Globally connected.
Exactly. Fast-paced.
Yeah.
Always on the go.
It's a different universe almost.
It is. And these fundamental differences, they create huge hurdles when we try to apply ancient guidelines directly to our 21st century lives.
I can see that.
So in this deep dive, we're establishing that essential cultural baseline. We're examining the farming practices and those vital community relationships in ancient Israel.
Gotcha.
And our focus is going to be particularly on how this all connects to social justice for what Dr. Harbin calls WARA.
WARAR.
It's an acronym he uses just for efficiency to refer to.
Okay.
Widows, orphans, and resident aliens.
Okay. WIBRA, got it.
Yeah.
Widows, orphans, resident aliens.
Right. And to really get a handle on this ancient world,
yeah,
Dr. Harbin draws on some pretty compelling sources.
Like what?
Well, first of all, we have archaeological findings, obviously.
Of course.
Tangible evidence.
Right, right.
But then he also incorporates this really fascinating study of a modern-day Jordanian village.
Wow, interesting.
It's by anthropologist Richard Antoine, and it's detailed in his book, Arab Village.
Okay.
Antoine's work is so valuable because, surprisingly, the agricultural techniques he observed,
yeah,
they bear a remarkable resemblance to the ones described in the Old Testament.
Wow, that's interesting. So there's still continuity.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But even more importantly, his research offers insights into how the village's structure, its physical layout,
right,
actually influenced community bonds and how they administered justice.
Mm.
Dr. Harbin points out that this aspect is often overlooked by scholars.
Really? Why do you think that is?
Well, I guess it seems like such a basic thing.
Yeah, maybe.
But you know what really struck me from the lecture?
What's that?
The way Dr. Harbin described these ancient Israelite villages.
Okay.
He talks about the houses being built so close together, sometimes even sharing walls.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly you're out in these vast, unfenced fields stretching as far as the eye can see.
Wow, that's a striking image.
It is. And guess what? Archaeological discoveries from the late Bronze Age in Israel.
Yeah.
They actually confirm this layout.
So it's not just speculation. They really lived like that.
Exactly. So think about that for a second. No fences. What does that tell us about their sense of community?
Mm-hmm.
About shared resources?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
It makes you think about how differently they must have viewed land ownership.
Right. And then there's this map from Antoine's study of Kafr al-Ma, this Jordanian village.
Okay.
What fascinated Dr. Harpin is that the village, it's not just the cluster of homes, you know, like we typically imagine. It encompasses the entire geographical area.
Oh, I see.
Both the residential area and all the surrounding farmland.
So, like, the village was a living, breathing entity extending beyond just the houses.
It's a completely different perspective, right?
Yeah.
And it really highlights how interconnected life was in these ancient communities.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about your individual dwelling. It was about this larger collective.
That must have fostered a much stronger sense of shared responsibility.
Absolutely. But maybe also greater vulnerability for those who didn't quite fit in, you know?
That's an interesting point. We'll have to explore that more later.
Definitely. And based on this comparison with Kafr al-Ma, we can start to picture what an Israelite village might have looked like.
Okay, like what?
So imagine this central grouping of houses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Surrounded immediately by garden plots.
Okay.
Then moving outward, you'd find olive groves.
Olive groves.
Hmm. Then further out, the bigger grain fields.
Right.
And finally, way out there, woodlands used for grazing and sourcing wood and stuff.
So it's almost like these concentric rings radiating out from the heart of the village.
Exactly.
That's a really cool visual.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Harbin also addresses something that can be kind of confusing.
Okay, what's that?
It's the terms village, town, and city, which are often used interchangeably in archaeological literature.
Yeah, that's true. It does get a bit messy.
It does. But he clarifies, drawing on the work of Frank Frick, that the main distinction wasn't size.
Okay.
Or even defensive walls.
Which you might think would be the defining feature of a city.
Right. Although cities were often walled,
yeah,
the key difference, he says, was the level of administration.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Cities functioned as these central hubs, managing the agricultural surplus from the surrounding smaller settlements.
So the villages and hamlets.
Exactly.
So in a way, the cities were kind of like the administrators of the region's resources.
That's a good way to put it.
And this village structure, this whole system, it must have had a profound impact on the daily life of the average person, the average farmer.
Oh, absolutely. And that, in turn, shaped their family life.
Hmm. In what way?
Well, it probably cultivated this feeling of the entire village being one big interconnected unit.
Rather than just individual families living separate lives.
Exactly. And yeah. Think about the support networks that would have naturally emerged in such a close-knit setting.
That's a really good point. It's a built-in safety net almost.
Right. Think about the Book of Ruth, for instance.
Okay.
Dr. Harbin uses it as an example of a narrative that gives us a glimpse into this very agricultural system.
Right.
And its social customs.
Yeah.
And it's significant that Ruth herself is introduced as both a widow.
No.
And a resident alien.
Right.
Two of those key Wara groups.
Wara, right. The widows, orphans, and resident aliens.
Exactly.
It's interesting how the story of Ruth kind of subtly reveals aspects of this community structure, you know?
Oh, yeah. How so?
Well, when she goes out to glean, the text refers to the field, singular.
No, I see.
And specifically, the portion of the fields belonging to Boaz.
Right.
This suggests that individuals had ownership rights to certain plots within that larger communal area.
So there's this idea of private ownership.
Yeah.
Within a larger system of communal land use.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating blend of individual and collective responsibility.
And that detail, you know, where it says Ruth happening to come on the portion of the field belonging to Boaz.
Yeah.
It strongly implies that there weren't physical fences separating these plots.
That's interesting, because you'd think with all the stones in that region.
Right. You'd think they'd be used for building fences.
Naturally, but apparently not.
Dr. Harbin actually talks about this.
He does.
Yeah, he discusses the subtle differences in the Hebrew words translated as corner versus edge in Leviticus.
Okay.
In the context of gleaning. He suggests that if there were no physical barriers, it would have made it much easier for the poor to glean from those leftover harvests in neighboring fields.
Hmm, that makes sense. It would have been a much more fluid, open system.
And he also mentions, citing Tarkowski, that larger stones were used as boundary markers.
Oh, okay.
But even then, Deuteronomy cautions against moving them.
So they weren't these massive, immovable walls.
Right, more like temporary markers.
So where did all the other stones go if they weren't used for fences?
Well, Dr. Harbin suggests they might have been used in the construction of those tightly packed houses.
That's a good point. They had to put those stones somewhere.
Exactly.
So we've talked about the fields and the houses.
Huh?
But what about other important structures? Like, what about the threshing floor?
Ah, yes. The threshing floor.
Where was that located? And what was its significance?
Okay, so Dr. Harbin describes it as being situated on elevated ground.
Okay.
Windy ground.
Why windy?
Because that was crucial for winnowing.
Ah, right, of course. Yeah. Separating the grain from the chaff.
Exactly. And he actually shows this really cool visual example from southern Spain.
Oh, cool.
To illustrate this crucial step in the agricultural process.
So did every family have their own threshing floor? Or was it more of a communal thing?
That's a good question. It seems like it could be either.
Okay.
Dr. Harbin mentions the example of Ornan the Jebusite, who had his own private threshing floor.
Right.
But then there's also evidence suggesting communal ones.
Okay.
And given how close together the houses were,
yeah,
Dr. Harbin thinks that threshing floors were probably located a bit outside the main residential area.
That makes sense. You wouldn't want all that chaff blowing through the village.
Right. Imagine that.
It's interesting how even something as seemingly mundane as a threshing floor can give us insights into their social customs.
It really is, especially when you consider that the process of threshing and winnowing, it took several days.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't a quick job. And because it was located some distance from the village, and it took so long, it became customary to spend the night there.
Oh, I see.
We see this in the story of Ruth, too.
Right, right.
So even these agricultural tasks, they had this communal aspect.
It fostered a certain level of social interaction.
Right, you know, right.
And interdependence.
Exactly. Now, beyond the cultivated fields, there were also woodlands.
Woodlands. Okay, what were those used for?
They served as grazing land for sheep and goats.
Ah, got it.
Mm-mm.
So their livestock had a separate area.
Right, and this was different from the lifestyle of the Bedouin tribes, who were more nomadic.
Okay, so the Israelites had a more settled approach to raising livestock.
Exactly. And Dr. Harbin points out something really interesting. After the harvest, they would bring the livestock to graze on the harvested fields.
Oh, to clean up the leftover stalks and stuff.
That's right. And that gives us context for the image of shepherds in the fields in Luke 2.8.
Oh, right, the Christmas story. It all connects.
It does.
Yeah.
So you can see how these villages were largely self-sufficient.
Yeah, with the farmland, the grazing areas, all within the community's territory.
Exactly. Now, to really understand the social dynamics at play, we need to consider the historical context.
Right, because the Torah wasn't just dropped out of the sky.
Exactly. Dr. Harbin reminds us that we have this interwoven history, starting with the patriarchs like Abraham, then the giving of the Torah at Sinai, and then the settlement of the land under Joshua.
And it's important to remember that the Torah wasn't introduced into a vacuum.
Absolutely.
God provided it to refine and elevate existing social customs.
Towards his standard of justice.
Exactly.
So there would have been elements of continuity from their existing culture.
Right.
Alongside these new divinely inspired principles.
It's a fascinating interplay of the old and the new.
It really is. And the settlement process itself, it played a huge role in shaping their social structure.
Okay, how so?
Well, initially the land was divided among the 12 tribes, right?
Right, right.
But then those tribal territories were further divided.
Among
smaller units.
Okay.
Clans and extended families.
Got it.
Who then settled in specific cities and villages.
Okay.
Each with its own local leadership.
So it wasn't just a top-down system. There was local governance, too.
Exactly. And this localized distribution of land, it had the most direct impact on the everyday lives of the average Israelite.
Because that's where they lived.
And it formed the basis of their social justice system at the grassroots level.
It's like building a society from the ground up.
Right. And according to the book of Joshua, this initial tribal land allocation was done by casting lots.
Casting lots. So like a random lottery system.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Dr. Harbin explains this as a way to be impartial.
Okay.
Because they believed the outcome was ultimately in God's hands.
So it wasn't just a matter of human decision making.
Right. And we get this picture of the larger tribal territories being assigned in this way.
But what about the smaller divisions? Like within the tribes.
That's what's interesting. While the outcome of these tribal divisions is recorded, the Bible doesn't give us a detailed account of the specific method they used to divide the land further.
Among the clans and extended families.
Right. So there's some room for interpretation there.
For scholarly debate.
Exactly. But we do know from the Book of Numbers
yeah.
that land was distributed according to families.
Okay.
And Dr. Harbin stresses that all these families,
uh-huh.
they shared this common experience,
ooh.
The 40 years in the wilderness.
Right, where God provided for them.
Exactly. So this land distribution, it was a new beginning for them in many ways.
A fresh start.
Yeah. But also a challenging one.
Oh, how so?
Because most of them would have had limited experience with the kind of agriculture they needed in Canaan.
Different from Egypt.
Completely.
Okay.
Egypt was irrigated.
Right.
Canaan was rainfall dependent.
So a much more unpredictable climate.
Exactly.
So who exactly were these families who received the land?
Well, in theory, it was the descendants of Jacob.
Okay.
But the reality is, the group that left Egypt,
yeah.
it's described as a mixed company.
Oh, interesting. So not just the direct descendants.
Right. And when we look at the census records in Numbers,
uh-huh.
they refer to groups as families and fathers' households.
Okay.
Which scholars generally understand to mean clans and extended families.
So those middle layers between the larger tribe and the smaller nuclear family.
Exactly.
What did an extended family look like in this context?
Well, it probably included at least three generations living together.
Okay.
But it could even encompass a wider network of descendants within a village.
So a lot of people in a village could be related.
Yeah.
Even if distantly.
Exactly.
That must have created a very strong sense of kinship and shared identity.
Absolutely. And it would have had a huge impact on how they supported each other.
And how they viewed those who weren't part of that kinship network.
Right.
So how did this land allocation actually work on a practical level?
Well, it probably happened at the clan level first.
Okay.
With each clan being assigned a specific area.
Centered around.
Maybe a particular city or group of villages.
Gotcha.
And within that area, the clan leader would then further divide the land among the families.
The extended families.
Right.
And how did they determine who got what? Was it just random?
They might have continued using lots.
Okay.
Or the clan leader might have just allocated it directly.
Okay.
We don't know for sure.
And how much land did each family get?
That's not specified either.
So was it just like a free-for-all? Everyone got as much as they could grab?
No, it wasn't like that.
Okay.
Dr. Harbin estimates it to have been around 5 acres per adult male.
5 acres. Okay.
Which aligns with what we see in other ancient agricultural societies.
And even some modern ones.
That's right.
Now, we tend to think of ancient Israel as being entirely agricultural.
Yeah.
But Dr. Harbin points out that by the Iron Age,
yeah.
specialized trades started to emerge.
He
cites scholars like King and Stager.
Right.
But that's a bit outside our scope for today.
It is. We're focusing on that initial settlement period.
Gotcha.
But that clan-based settlement pattern,
yeah.
it suggests that villages were largely homogeneous.
Meaning?
That most of the residents were related in some way.
So it was a very tight-knit social structure.
Exactly. And that would have had a big impact on the social support systems available.
Especially for those who didn't fit neatly into those family units.
Like widows and orphans.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's try to sum up what we've learned so far about daily life in an Israelite village.
Okay, good idea.
We're talking about tight-knit related communities
right.
where face-to-face interaction and peer pressure were probably huge factors.
Yeah.
Farmers would walk to their fields every day.
Often to scattered plots,
right,
taking yeah. their meals with them.
Exactly. The size of those plots was determined by what a family could realistically farm.
Makes sense.
And we might have seen smaller settlements spring up around a central city.
Satellite hamlets.
Yeah.
To support those farming more distant land.
That's right.
It's interesting to think about the logistics of all of this.
It is, isn't it?
Like, how far would a farmer have to travel to reach his fields?
Well, Dr. Harbin suggests that the overall territory
yeah.
of a city and its surrounding villages.
Uh-huh.
might have been around 6 to 7 miles in diameter.
Okay, so not a huge distance.
No, but still a daily commute on foot.
Yeah, that's a good workout.
And the land between those urban clusters,
yeah.
it was probably uncultivated.
Maybe even forested in some areas.
Right.
It's funny how we tend to imagine the ancient world as being completely different from ours.
Yeah.
But in some ways, they face similar challenges.
Oh, absolutely. Like having to commute to work.
Exactly.
And then we have examples like Caleb in the Book of Judges.
Caleb?
Yeah.
What about him?
He shows us that clan leaders could grant specific portions of land to individuals.
Even after that initial tribal distribution.
Right.
So there was some flexibility in the system.
There was.
Maybe that's how they dealt with population growth.
Or maybe they allocated less desirable land later on.
Or gave it to younger sons as families expanded.
That's right. And it seems like those individual land portions weren't all in one block.
Okay.
They were spread out.
Oh, like dispersed.
Exactly.
Like what Antoine observed in that Jordanian village.
That's right. Remember Caleb's daughter?
Yeah.
She asks for access to springs in addition to her field.
So her field didn't necessarily have water on it?
Right.
So they had to think about water sources separately.
They did.
How big would you say a single field portion was?
Well, based on what we know about travel in the Middle East today,
yeah,
it was probably around half an acre to an acre.
Okay.
And if a family inherited, say, 3 to 5 acres in total, they would have had multiple plots in different locations.
So they weren't just stuck with one type of soil or terrain.
Exactly. And it also means they could grow a variety of crops.
And manage variations in productivity.
That's right. And this might explain why, when they sold land,
yeah,
they often only sold a portion of their holdings.
Until the Jubilee year.
Exactly.
Now, what about the grazing land?
The grazing land?
Yeah, where was that located in relation to the village?
Oh, that was further out, beyond the cultivated fields.
So the livestock weren't just wandering around the village?
No. They were kept in those pastures probably overnight.
Away from the houses.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want them trampling your crops.
Exactly. And here's another important point.
Okay.
Houses weren't part of the initial land distribution.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where were they located then?
They were all in the community center.
Oh, interesting.
So even if a family had to lease out their fields due to hardship,
yeah,
they would still have their home in the village.
That makes sense. It provides a basic level of security.
Exactly. Think about Naomi and Ruth. They returned to their house in Bethlehem after the famine in Moab.
Right.
Elimelech, Naomi's husband, he probably still owned the house.
Even though his fields were unworked.
Exactly. And this principle of inherited land,
yeah,
it was crucial.
Okay.
Land couldn't be sold permanently.
It was passed down from father to son.
Exactly. Though it could be divided among the heirs.
With the oldest son getting a double portion.
Right.
And as families grew, I guess younger sons might have been granted new land.
Previously uncultivated land on the outskirts of the community's territory.
Makes sense. You have to expand somehow.
And what about widows? How were they provided for?
Good question.
It seems that the customary practice was for them to live with their married sons.
Okay.
Supported by the extended family.
And probably contributing labor as they were able.
Exactly.
So this gives us a baseline for understanding the situation of widows in this society.
It does, which is important for when we look at those specific social justice provisions intended for them.
Right.
One last thing. Dr. Harbin revisits the distinction between cities and villages.
Okay.
While fortified cities became more common over time,
yeah,
it wasn't an absolute division.
Right.
Villages often served as agricultural satellites.
Around those urban centers.
Right. Providing easier access to fields for farmers.
And maybe offering refuge during times of conflict.
That's right. And the cities themselves.
Yeah.
They became hubs for commerce and specialized crafts.
Indicating a more complex social structure developing over time.
Exactly. So by laying out this foundation.
The village life.
Yeah. The agrarian practices.
And those family and community relationships.
Right. We've set the stage for exploring those specific social justice provisions.
Designed for.
Widows, orphans, and resident aliens.
The Wari group.
Exactly. That Dr. Harbin dives into later in his lecture.
It raises some profound questions about their place in this society.
It does. And about the reasons for their collective treatment in terms of social justice.
It's like we've been digging down into the soil, metaphorically speaking.
We have. To understand the lay of the land.
Exactly. So, to recap,
yeah,
we've seen a society deeply rooted in agriculture.
Right.
Living in close-knit villages.
With open fields.
And a strong sense of community.
Interconnectedness.
Exactly. We've looked at the system of land distribution.
From the tribes down to the families.
And we've gained insights into daily life for the average Israelite.
That's right. And as we stressed at the beginning,
yeah,
this understanding is absolutely essential for interpreting those timeless biblical principles of social justice.
Particularly as they relate to the Wara group.
Exactly. And this brings us to a question for you, the listener.
Okay.
Considering how close-knit these communities were,
yeah,
where almost everyone was related to some degree,
right,
how might this have